Welcome to another Left, Right, and Center. I am David Green, and I want to start this week with a question. Are we spending too much time focused on the protests that are unfolding on college campuses around our country and the crackdowns and the arrests that have followed, and not enough time on the conflict that led to the protests in the first place? The death in Gaza, the hostages still held, the political realities that are fueling this conflict. I mean, listen to this coverage.
Chaotic scenes playing out at colleges across the country as police try to break up campus protests. In New York City, police remain on Columbia University's campus after clearing out a campus building occupied by protesters last night.
So far, more than 1,000 people have been arrested since the demonstrations across college campuses against the war in Gaza began. At UCLA, hundreds of students and faculty walking out of class in support of the protests.
Today, the University of Wisconsin in Madison became the latest hotspot in clashes between pro-Palestinian demonstrators and police.
Back up!
More than 24 were arrested.
I mean, I'm not suggesting that these stories are not important in any way, but there is a question here, and it's one that was asked by Lorraine Ali. She's the news and culture critic for the LA Times. She raised this question in a piece this week. She said she didn't see enough headlines, for example, about mass graves that were discovered in Gaza. And she asked if the media is hyper-focused on how we protest atrocities rather than atrocities themselves. And so I want to start here with that question to our regular Left, Right, and Center crew. Sarah Isger is here. She's senior editor at The Dispatch. She's a lawyer and was spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. And Moa Lathy is here, executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. He was communications director for the Democratic National Committee and advised Hillary Clinton. So I'll just throw this question to both of you. Do these protests on our campuses deserve the wall-to-wall news coverage that we're seeing, or should we be seeing more from Gaza and the region?
I'll start by saying that it's not surprising. Foreign things rarely lead American news for very long. It was actually surprising how long the conflict did stay in the forefront of American news. So that's item number one.
Yeah.
Number two, though, is that I think it goes to the protesters' motives more than anything. They know that they have removed what they claim to be protesting for from all of the headlines, that it's all about them. And I think that was actually always the point. This is revolutionary cosplay, social justice cosplay. And, you know, there was a woman who posted this, and I think she's really onto something. Her name is Elika Laban. Elite students of Ivy League schools have glamorized oppression so much that they have now reached role play status to satisfy their fantasies. Here, the students have appropriated the suffering of Gazans and are cosplaying as living through a humanitarian crisis. In their American make-believe story where Ivy League infrastructure sets the scene, the students play Gazans and the school administrators play Israelis. Israel, the school, is blocking their basic humanitarian aid in this play, and if they don't receive it soon, they will die of thirst and starvation. These are all, of course, quotes from spokespeople from these protests. They also destroy upper-class buildings and claim them as liberated, while the students repeat chants in zombie-like chorus, playing the role of freedom fighters, destroying Israeli infrastructure and claiming them freed. You don't see this in lower-tier schools from kids of lower socioeconomic standing because they aren't plagued with the guilt of privilege that they're seeking to launder through Middle East role plays of feigned suffering.
I mean, I hear you, and I could see that being the case in some places, maybe some elite schools, but I'm skeptical that that's the case in every single scenario. I mean, I've seen the images of so many large numbers of students and others who seem to be fighting for the people in Gaza and not themselves. However, the psychology of what you're describing is interesting, I mean, to contemplate.
You know, it's interesting. You look at throughout history, there has always been an important role that media coverage of protest plays in shining a light on the subject, right? A lot of people credit CBS News and its cameras on the Pettus Bridge in Selma for shining a light on the brutality that the police were showing civil rights activists that they hadn't seen in other parts of the country before. So media covering protest can often lead to just a heightened awareness of the issue. I was struck, though, by how contentious the protesters on these campuses are towards the media today. And one anecdote, last weekend was the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and there was a not that big, but very loud protest outside of the venue protesting the media, yelling chants about how CBS and ABC and CNN were all complicit in genocide. And it seemed to me that the irony was lost on them that the only reason they knew about what was happening in Gaza was because of the media coverage. But here they were attacking the media for the way they were covering, or for the fact that they weren't covering it enough.
Right.
So I think that I think that there's a tension right now that we haven't seen in some past protest movements. I will say, though, the way these protests are being covered by the national media, I think, is missing a lot of the context on the ground in some places.
Context in the ground on the campuses, or like on the ground
on the
Gaza?
Campuses?
On the campuses.
On the campuses. And I know what we want to discuss is, are we focusing too much on the protests rather than what's happening in the region? But I think it's connected. Today's cable news media landscape loves a conflict, and they are seeing one. But what's really fascinating to me is talking to a lot of local reporters in the cities.
Mm-hmm.
I was in New York a few weeks ago when things were really starting to heat up at Columbia and NYU. And I was watching CNN in my hotel room, and I thought the city was about to burn. I was almost afraid to leave my hotel. And then I switched to the local news coverage, NY1. And they were talking about how remarkably peaceful it was. On the same campuses. They had reporters on the same campuses talking about how remarkably peaceful it was. And we've seen time and time again little stories pop up that don't get the same kind of attention about the Jewish students who are joining the protesters and feel very safe doing that. Or the Palestinian students who are yelling and trying to stop the agitators. Because they think it's hurting the cause and wrong to yell at Jewish students. And that doesn't get the same attention.
No, because the conflict plays better.
Right. And I'm not saying that the conflict doesn't exist. I'm not saying that there aren't anti-Semitic chants and they're terrible. But there's a lot more happening at these things. There's a lot of this nuance that isn't being seen because of the fact that the national media is so focused on the conflict, and the conflict is sexy. And I couldn't agree more with Sarah. She's absolutely right. Now that the conflict has come here,
mm-hmm.
to whatever level it is, that's going to be more appealing to national reporters than the underlying conflict that is tragic in the Middle East.
Yeah, well, there's another dynamic, like in newsrooms, that I think, you know, there are a few realities. One is it's really hard to get reporters into Gaza now, obviously. So news organizations, you know, have trouble covering, feeling like they even could cover what is happening on the ground. And also there's this dynamic that I've always struggled with in journalism. I mean, I've had a lot of editors, and I respect the hell out of them. But when there is a big story, it's like every morning at the news meeting, it's like, okay, how are we going to cover the big story that we have to cover? It's a lot easier to get, you know, cameras or reporters into college campuses anywhere in the country, pick and choose, than it is to try and cover the conflict, which is very complicated, dangerous abroad. So this is a way to cover the conflict that is sort of easier and more accessible. But I wanted to ask you both about this in sort of a different way, because what worries me is if the focus on this conflict is just easier and tidier for American news consumers to get a hold of. And also it fits into our current political narrative in some way. I want to bring up something written by Julia Yoffe at Puck News. I mean, she sort of went after both parties in a way. She said that the American left has been insistent and consistent in their stance that the personal safety and emotional well-being of marginalized groups is more important than a speaker's freedom of speech, why the change now? So she's suggesting some hypocrisy on in part of the left. She also went after Republicans and said that Republicans in all these protests are going after some of the things on their agenda. She said they're tackling a longstanding GOP hobby horse, which is the persecution of conservatives on liberal campuses. And also, this is giving Republicans the chance to emphasize the chaos they're trying to associate in voters' minds with the left in an election year. The more protests, the better. The more chaos there is, the more people like Donald Trump can come in and say, like, American cities and colleges are out of control. We have to do something. So it just feels, it's scary to me that this is feeding into our political anger. And I wonder if both parties are in a way not necessarily, I don't know, they might not want this news coverage to stop.
This is the same thing we see from an AOC or an Ilhan Omar or a Marjorie Taylor Greene or Matt Gaetz. It used to be when there were strong political parties that the political parties could sort of enforce a platform, candidates with carrots and sticks, et cetera. But now the incentives are to attack your own side for your own self-aggrandizement. And it becomes this horseshoe theory of politics in terms of tactics. And that's why you end up with, you know, folks on the right attacking these violent protesters and protests while defending January 6th, and vice versa, by the way. And look, I just want to say one thing about what Mo said. The idea that because there's some Jewish students who are on that side is the same thing I think that we find so offensive when someone says, well, Ben Carson and Tim Scott are Black and they're conservatives. Yeah, like it's tokenizing people because they're within, you know, this minority of the larger group. And the fact that there's a lot of people not committing assault, I also think isn't really the point when there's now been people hospitalized, taken to the emergency room. One Jewish woman was beaten unconscious, had a concussion. And then there have been pro-Israeli students now violently attacking the Palestinian protesters because the school told the police not to engage and not to keep the peace because of this fear about police involvement, which is outrageous. And again, like the protests can be meaningful and peaceful for the most part, but when you then have a human chain that blocks Jewish students from entering the campus or getting to the library or getting to their class, I don't really care if 90% are fine. It's the same as the Unite the Right rally in that sense. Oh, a woman was murdered, but only one person committed that murder compared to how many people were at that rally. You would never say that.
Let's be very clear. I'm not saying that these protests haven't gotten out of control. I absolutely agree with that. I think the anti-Semitism we're seeing, I think the barricading of buildings, all of that is absolutely horrible. But I think there is a narrative being created and fueled for political reasons. I think the conversation we're having would be very, very different if this wasn't an election year. This narrative that college campuses are burning and out of control is exacerbated by the agitators, whether they're from on campus or off, and I think there's a mix of both, when in reality, most of the people there are actually there protesting appropriately, and then it gets hijacked by some. But when you're in the middle of the crowd, you're finding a lot more, or at least the way it's being reported by local reporters who are on the ground, they are sensing at least last week, right? They were sensing a very, very different vibe. Now, I'm not defending what's happening on the campuses.
I know.
In fact, I actually think these protesters are doing their side a huge, huge disservice by the way they are protesting. The public sentiment against the Israeli government and the sentiment of allies of Israel politically had been waning, right? People were speaking up. They were being more critical. You were seeing heads of state from Western democracies speaking out more forcefully, demanding that Israel change the way it was waging this war. And even in the United States, you were sensing that. You're not sensing that now. Because when the anti-Semitic stuff, while I think it is a minority of what's happening on these campuses, when that rears its head, it suddenly it takes the political pressure off of Israel, and you see people rushing more to the defense of the Israeli government and the pro-Israel side in this argument. So as listeners of the show know, I am very sympathetic to the Palestinian cause while also being sympathetic to the people of Israel. But as someone who's sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, I'm watching the protesters actually doing a disservice and taking the pressure off of Israel to change the way it's waging the war.
All right, we'll pick this conversation up after a quick break. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. All right, we're back with Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Greene. We've been talking about the protests, the pro-Palestinian protests playing out on college campuses around the country and what we make of them and whether there's been more news coverage of the protests than the actual conflict itself that led to the protests and whether we're concerned about that. Mo, you were saying that while you sympathize with a lot of the pro-Palestinian protesters, some of what they've been doing has actually been a disservice to the cause of trying to hold the Israeli government accountable. Let's pick up there. I don't know if you wanted to add anything or Sarah, you jump in.
I just wanted to note that, if I, for instance, didn't want the bust of Robert E. Lee taken down because I don't think we should try to hide our history. I think we should confront our history. And so I showed up to the Unite the Right rally, let's say, for that purpose, an okay purpose. And then the people next to me were holding tiki torches and chanting, "Jews will not replace us." I think I would leave the protest. And I certainly wouldn't show up the next day to the protest. And if I did keep showing up day after day, as the people next to me were chanting, "Jews will not replace us," I don't think that the correct media reporting would be, well, a lot of the people there are there for the right reasons, or a lot of the people there are peaceful or not anti-Semitic. And so when I think about these protests on these college campuses, and Mo's pointing out that, a lot of the students do care about Gazans, or a lot of the students aren't anti-Semitic. I don't know, man. They're hearing this. They're watching their fellow students block Jews from campus. And I just don't see how you can show up the next day and say, "Yeah, but I'm not anti-Semitic." Like, no, at some point, you're choosing to associate with people and you know what they're saying and you know what they're doing. And I'll hold the schools even far more responsible because, by the way, these students are getting mixed messages at best, right? The schools are like, "Please don't do this. This violates our policy." Wink, wink, definitely keep doing it. They've had, class after class on the righteousness of protests and on how bad Israel is and colonialism and oppression and all of these things. And then they keep telling them, "We're going to call the police," but then they don't. "You need to leave, but you don't have to." And so then when they do call the police, I can see why the students are pretty confused by that. But this gets to a rot in these elite institutions because it comes in the admissions part, right? They chose these students for their campus. And they chose students based on their commitment to activism and social justice. They didn't choose them based on their commitment to intellectual humility or curiosity. They picked students to put in a concentrated environment that were 100% confident at 17 years old that their worldview was correct and they didn't need it challenged. They simply wanted the tools, the illiberal tools, to fight against the oppressors as they defined them. And that's why these protests have become such a violent clash, because you've got basically two groups who are minority groups, and only one side is getting the benefit of that university experience of, righteousness.
I mean, I this is a whole conversation that we could go deeply down, but you're saying you think admissions officers at these elite schools have deliberately chosen student bodies that are like ready to be radical activists?
Absolutely. In fact, many of the questions on the essay questions now, I saw one recently from an Ivy League school that said, "Our commitment to diversity, equity, inclusion is one of the hallmarks of our educational process. What have you done to further the cause of social justice in your community?"
You and I will be in agreement that university administrators have not handled this well, right? And I think the fact that too many of them around the country, look, and I'm on a campus that has been very peaceful. We've had demonstrations, but they've been appropriate protest movements. And I knock wood whenever I say this, but it is, I look at some of these other universities where all they had to do was be very clear at the front end: you have a right to protest, you do not have a right to put fear into other students. You do not have right to occupy territory on the campus that you should not occupy. You do not have the right to barricade doors. If you believe in academic freedom, then begin with letting your classmates go to class. That is academic freedom. So I'm with you. I think that too many university administrators were not clear about what they considered appropriate protest on their campus. And that's not regulating speech. That's just putting some parameters around how you exercise your speech. Having said that, I just find objectionable the argument that because they're asking students about their commitment and their experience with social justice, they are automatically creating an entire generation of radical activists. That's just not the case, and that's just not what's
seen. No, they're credentialing an entire generation of radical activists.
Okay, I think we should have this debate some other time, because it's fascinating, and I would love to look at some of the things that you're bringing up, Sarah, like the questions that admissions officers ask now, and like what that might lead to. I'm skeptical too of what you're saying, but like I think we should have this conversation. I just want to say that in a way, because we have to move on, we've proven the point from the beginning of the show. Like the fact that there is so much attention and so much to kind of chew on and talk about because of all the coverage we've all been seeing of what's happening on college campuses, like it is so easy to drift away from the heart of what, you know, I feel like a lot of the conversation should be. I mean,
I'll just note that I think we should also talk about these schools' legal liability, all the lawsuits being filed, because they have violated Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, and they have violated the First Amendment rights of their students, not the protesters. The other students, by not enforcing their permit process or the encampment rules, they're preventing other students from being able to use that space to have their speech. And so these schools have set themselves up for enormous legal liability, and the lawsuits are already pouring in. And that doesn't even get us to the lawsuits about the violence that the schools have allowed by not allowing police on present.
Well, speaking of lawsuits, you gave me the perfect segue to the next topic that I would like to cover on our show today. And that really gets to this big question, I think, that we've been talking about this election year, which is, what is the federal government's role in the culture war raging in our country? A handful of Republican-led states have just sued the Biden administration over rules that would extend the protections of Title IX to a wider group of students, including those who identify as transgender. The new Title IX regulation says that a school cannot deny, quote, a transgender student access to a sex-separate facility or activity consistent with that student's gender identity. This did not sit well with states like Florida and Texas and others. One lawsuit that was filed by Idaho, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Montana said that this new Biden rule is, quote, nowhere close to legal. It is, quote, an affront to the dignity of families and school administrators everywhere. Those states called this rule a naked attempt to strong-arm our schools into molding our children in the current federal government's preferred image of how a child should think, act, and speak. There's, of course, a separate debate over a Biden administration rule on the rights of transgender student athletes, and this is not even mentioning the raging debate over abortion and the question of whether the courts or Congress or states or voters should decide access to abortion in our country. So let's start with these new lawsuits. I mean, the Biden administration believes it's protecting the rights of a marginalized group. The right sees this as strong-arming schools into molding children into the government's preferred image. I mean, how do we even resolve that?
On the substance of this, again, I know we hit this every week on this podcast, but everyone has to remember, no matter what side you find yourself on now, this is about process. Who do you want making these decisions? So even if you like this policy, you should be wary about how the policy got made and the ability of the next side that you don't agree with being able to make a similar policy on the other side. This is not legislative. This means that the next president, if Donald Trump were to win, in the first 6 months could repeal this and put the opposite in place. So if you do like this, be concerned about this. And if you don't like it,
be concerned about the way the Title IX is being handled. Like one administration can do one thing, the next can do another thing, and it can just keep flip-flopping.
And that perhaps we don't want the federal government doing this at all, or we at least want it to be the product of compromise and the slow, miserable legislative process that comes from working through this where you have to have sort of everyone at the table. When you get totally your way, it's just not lasting. It's not stable. And this applies to every debate we're having about anything. If you care about climate change, you shouldn't want it done through executive action. You should want it done through Congress. And if you care about trans rights, same thing. But I guess on the substantive side of this, it's really important to understand that if you're on the right, if you hate this, then again, you should be fighting for the process here, not just, well, I hope my guy gets elected so that we can do the opposite thing. Because again, you've also opened the door then to when your side loses, and then this will be legal. On the process side, though, this is what the new political process is, that the governors and the party out of power get political bona fides on their side by suing the administration. And just to sort of use one set of numbers, and I'm going to use nationwide injunctions where a governor sues a president to stop the policy from going into place in any state, not just the state that the governor is in. Barack Obama had 19 universal injunctions against his administration during 8 years. Donald Trump had 55 universal injunctions during his first 3 years in office, I believe. And the Biden administration, I think, is at least on pace for that, if not improving upon that record.
And what's a universal injunction?
This is the idea that when you sue the administration, you forum shop, you find a judge from, you know, quote unquote, your side, okay, to get them to stop the policy from going into effect anywhere in the country, not just against the people suing, not just against the state that the lawsuit came from, but against the whole country. And so it takes years to get that resolved. And in the meantime, the administration's policy never goes into effect. And so each side decries it when they're in power and they can't get their policies in effect. And this is exactly where this case is going to go as well. And the problem is that we reward the people from our side who are doing it. So when Governor Newsom from California was filing, I mean, most of those 55 universal injunctions against the Trump administration were from Governor Newsom. Mm-hmm. And the left was like, yay, this is amazing. And now that it's Governor Abbott or Governor DeSantis doing it from Florida, they're like, you know what? These universal injunctions really, you know, stand in the way of the efficient administration of justice, and elections should matter. And well, yes, but we need to pick one process and agree to abide by the results of it, regardless of who wins or loses. And I think that's the problem across the board, whether we're talking about the Supreme Court or this school guidance. The side that loses doesn't want to accept that, instead of us agreeing on a process to do this, where, yep, sometimes you're going to lose and sometimes you might win more or less, or it's compromise and all these things. You will never get your way, but it will be stable that way.
Yeah, I think I'm going to agree with a lot of that in the sense that, you know, and Sarah gave an example of sort of hypocrisy on the left. I'll give an example of hypocrisy on the right. You know, how often over the past couple of decades have we heard Republicans railing against activist judges who are stepping in and legislating from the bench? And now you are seeing, because there's a Democrat in the White House, Republican governors trying to put it in the hand of judges instead of to essentially legislate from the bench. So there's real hypocrisy on this whole thing. And I agree. I mean, one thing I think Sarah and I have consistently agreed on this show is the need to actually have a working legislative process. And with the fact that our legislative process is so crippled right now, it is leading the president, whether it was Obama or Trump or Biden, to take measures into their own hands to move policy. And it's leading more and more judges being asked to weigh in on that. And so we're seeing what should be handled through legislative action instead being a fight between an administration and the courts, time after time after time. And the members of our legislature are aiding and abetting that, not just by not doing their job, but by encouraging governors to file these lawsuits.
Correct.
All right, you're listening to Left, Right, and Center from KCRW. And we're talking about the culture war, some of the lawsuits that have been filed against the Biden administration, and how we see this constant sort of states controlled by the party out of power, suing the administration for taking certain actions, and whether this is the right way to decide some of these big issues. And I guess I want to say to you both, like, the tension I see is that on so many of these really hard issues, a lot of the country as a whole is in the middle. I mean, that's a reality, and we're seeing a reflection of that. But also, some of these issues are so deeply, deeply personal. If we were to allow this to play out this way, you know, we have this question of whether states or the federal government or who should be making these decisions. Let's say we reach a point where it's like, okay, if Ron DeSantis wants to say that the state of Florida does not need to enforce these rules from the Biden administration, they get to decide how to treat the trans community in the state of Florida. If some states want to say, like, abortion is something that should be all but illegal in this state, then they want to make the argument that is the case. But are we ready as a society? Is someone who is fervently, you know, pro-life and believes that abortion is murder, are they willing to say, okay, but if, like, these 19 states believe that there should be very wide access to abortion, I'm willing to live with that because my governor is going to protect me? If you believe that, I mean, protecting the trans community is just a matter of human rights, no matter who believes what where, are you willing to say, well, I live in a state that is going to protect, you know, the trans community, if the state of Florida can do whatever it wants? That's what's so messy here in this whole debate over how this is done. But you're both saying that legislative action might somehow fix this, but I don't know. I don't see it. I feel like this mess is just reflective of our society right now.
It should fix it. It should fix it. We should, right? That legislative action should be where we come together. And for many of the rights that we have granted citizens throughout, you know, our history, many of them, not all, many of them, though, have been determined by legislative action, particularly when it came to voting rights and a lot of the landmark civil rights progress that we have seen. Now, not all, right? The Supreme Court did have to weigh in order to guarantee universal access to marriage in this country. And so there is a role.
What's so interesting about that? I'll make a slight footnote there. I don't know that that's true. So you take Brown v. Board of Education, the Supreme Court steps in and says that segregated schools are not constitutional. The schools didn't desegregate until Congress acted 10 years right. later.
Yeah.
And then you take Obergefell. Yes, the court legalized and rather constitutionalized same-sex marriage in 2015. I would argue that was going to happen regardless. The court got ahead of it, and that's why you haven't seen any real backlash, continued conversation about it, because there the court was sort of already part of the cultural trend, and that in fact it proves the point that lasting change is done through culture, through legislation, through compromise, through not this spoils system of politics, which
the
is
cultural
what we have
trend.
Right now.
It literally system tracks where the American electorate is.
That's right.
And the American electorate is sort of in the middle or divided. This is what we're going to see.
Check out.
And is that bad?
Check out Alabama. Check out Arizona. So Alabama Supreme Court holds that their laws ban IVF for all intents and purposes. And the Alabama legislature could not have moved faster to clarify. No, in Alabama, IVF is totally protected, maybe even more protected legally than it should be in terms of lawsuits that you can bring against IVF providers when they do something actually wrong. And Arizona, the Supreme Court there held that the 1864 law was actually still in place, which banned almost all abortions in the state. And lo and behold, the Arizona legislature jumped to, because of the political pressure, to actually put in place a law that matched far more closely with where the people and voters of the state of Arizona are. That's how we want it to work.
Yeah, but the problem is that's not how it always does work, right? And the greatest example in my mind is the abortion issue, where you do see that overturning Roe v. Wade was resoundingly unpopular, right, amongst a majority of the American people. And now, because of that decision, which was not the court getting out ahead of public opinion, it was the court lagging way behind public opinion, you are now seeing this fight in state after state after state
No, that's the way it's supposed to be. That's the way it's supposed to work. The court didn't get ahead or behind. The court just returned it to the political process. It had been out of the political process for 50 years, which is why we were still fighting about it, was because it hadn't been allowed to work through the cultural side, because the court said there was no legislation allowed on abortion.
And I guess where I disagree is that it had been. It had worked its way through the cultural side. Culturally, in the United States, there is overwhelming opposition to banning abortion. I'm not saying some restrictions, but states were already. But yeah, it was.
Every Republican, in the Senate was in the minus two, maybe not even. Every Republican was pro-life. Every Democrat was pro-choice. That's not overwhelming anything.
But that's if you are judging public opinion by solely the Senate. By where they're by the Senate.
Polls
right?
show that the majority of the country want some level of abortion access.
Wants access.
Yes, but they
to
also
abortion.
Polling shows that they don't want it till 9 months. Most of the country, like you said, David, is somewhere in the middle, and the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision wasn't allowing to work out what that was as the viability that, line moved, as science
were,
moved.
Weren't states free to do whatever they wanted as long as Roe basically said that the right of abortion must be protected. And
I've worked on so many gubernatorial campaigns in my life where we were having these conversations as part of the political process about certain restrictions, but not on whether or not there should be a ban. And so, you know, the states did have the ability to work out some of these issues without it,
no,
right?
They didn't. That's just not accurate.
They did.
So the laws.
Why did Roe, when it was in place, prevent states from working out the specifics?
Because it said that there was a constitutional right to an abortion pre-viability. So anytime in the first trimester, it also set up the whole trimester thing, which actually obviously doesn't exist in law. What Roe v. Wade said was in the first trimester, there can be no limits on abortion. In the run-up to viability, you can have some licensing, basically, restrictions. And after viability, then you can have restrictions, et cetera. And so what states had done in 2015 in Texas and in 2019 in Louisiana, they had tried to do that pre-viability restrictions.
Okay, so it made it harder for states to do what they wanted on...
The Supreme Court struck down both times the licensing requirements for doctors, for hospitals, surgical requirements of how close an emergency room basically had to be. All of that was struck down because of Roe v. Wade. Dobbs, remember, the case that overturned Roe v. Wade, was a state trying to have a 15-week ban on abortion. Pre-15 weeks, you can have an abortion. Post-15 weeks, you can't. Roe v. Wade was setting, again, viability, depending on who you ask, probably 24 weeks. So again, we were talking about the difference between 15 and 24 weeks, but pre-24 weeks, states could not legislate anything about abortion.
All right, we're gonna have to move on. That's an agree to disagree moment on whether the Roe decision was in place reflected where America was and kind of the cultural moment 100%. That we had arrived at.
This is
I'm glad we talked about this for a little while, because clearly on these big questions, it is an open question how best to reflect where America is on some of these hard issues. And I mean, this gives good context to a lot of the back and forth that I'm sure we're going to keep seeing between the states and the Biden administration, and probably the states and whichever administration is in power after this next election. Okay, we're going to move on. We're going to come back and go to our 50 states segment and visit the state of Idaho in a moment. We'll have more Left, Right, and Center. All right, we're back again with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. Sarah Isger is here. She's senior editor at The Dispatch, as well as Moa Lathy, who is executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. Well, it is a rare day in the state of Idaho. For the first time in three decades, a Democrat is running for state legislature in every district in the state. Yes, they are long shots in this deeply red state, but they say they are not just doing this to prove a point. They want to showcase, these candidates do, where they think Republicans have gone too extreme, hoping that convinces some voters to reconsider, if not now, then maybe down the road. Well, one of the Democrats running is Lori Peery. She told Politico that she is taking on the Republican who represents her district, Heather Scott, because Scott is spending time on needless issues, such as proposing to expand Idaho's anti-cannibalism law.
In one of the most anticipated moments of the morning,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Republican Representative Heather Scott stepped to the podium in the House State Affairs Committee.
RS 31078, cannibalism. And I know this seems like it's a heavy topic, actually. It might seem kind of gruesome, and it kind of is.
Cannibalism is already a crime in Idaho.
So why is Heather Scott focusing on cannibalism? Well, one reason, she said, was she saw a food show where one of the secret ingredients was human flesh. And actually, it turned out that it was part of a prank on the show. But she is spending time on that. So Lori Peery, the Democrat who was running against her, said that running against Heather Scott forces Republicans to work. It forces Scott to get out there and talk to people so they can see what she's about. It forces Republicans to spend more resources on the races. So this is part of our 50 states project on the show. We look at a story in each state, see what we can learn about our larger political conversation. And I want to say to you both, I got into this story in Idaho because we talk so much about the power of the extreme wings of both parties and how there is this silent majority in the middle. And here we have the out of power party saying, let's run in races to make some of these candidates answer for their more extreme ideas and actions. And I wonder, you know, on both sides, if this is one way, if we see this in a grassroots way in different states of reigning in the extreme and giving power back to the middle. What do you both think? Is this useful?
If there's not a choice, then there's no choice. If there's not a choice presented to voters, then the extremes do win. And, you know, we've talked about this in the context of how our districts are drawn and how, you know, through gerrymandering, we've created more all red districts and more all blue districts, and there are fewer and fewer swing districts. And so therefore, the fight's always at the margins within party primaries. But if you don't run, if you don't compete, people either don't know what's going on or they just don't have a choice in what's going on. So I'm all for it. I came up through a lot of my career was spent in Virginia. And there were, when I first got started in Virginia politics, there was, I think, maybe a third or ballpark of state legislative districts in which Democrats didn't even put up candidates. And so the Republican General Assembly just got more and more extreme and strident. Over the course of a decade, the party made a real effort to recruit candidates in every district, and it took a while, but now the Virginia General Assembly is split down the middle. It's 50-50 or close to, and you are seeing people actually having to work on both sides.
Although Virginia is different politically than Idaho, I guess it's worth noting.
Absolutely. But at the time, you know, it was an incredibly conservative General Assembly that did not reflect where a majority of Virginians were, because a majority of Virginians didn't have a choice to make. Now they do. So, look, I think it's a good thing when we are running people, when both parties are running people in every race, to give voters that choice.
Yeah, I mean, okay. philosophically, I agree with that. I think there's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem. Like, okay, the people in Ohio got a choice, and so they've moved, you know, wildly to the right in the state of Ohio. I don't think that's because they actually had a choice in their elections. I think it's because the state population became more conservative as people moved in and as the sort of culture of the state changed. I think the same thing happened in Virginia. It's not because there was a choice. There was a choice because the political environment in the state had changed. But I mean, chicken and egg, like I said, you're right. You do need a choice for there to be any change, and someone has to be that first person to go on the ballot, even if they're going to lose, to show, hey, look, I only lost by 5. Oh, and the next time I only lost by 2, et cetera. But Mo is not being totally honest with y'all in terms of like political operative Mo. He's giving you like happy philosophy Mo. Political operative Mo will tell you that
I like happy philosophy Mo, but
we'll find out.
Well, yeah, no, tell the voters, tell the listeners what I'm thinking.
political operatives will tell you that money is fungible, right? So as you spread out donor money, and there's a limited number of people who are going to give to political races, and you spread out party money, whether state party or federal party money, that money is going into one race means it's not going into another race. And we've certainly seen on the Democratic side, especially, tons, bagillions of dollars go into unwinnable races. So I don't think it was like, oh, look, we provided the people of Kentucky a choice when Amy McGrath ran against McConnell. What happened was that it ended up being this nationalized race. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Mo, something like $90 million was spent in that race for Democrats.
It was ridiculous. It was a ridiculous
amount. And that money was lit on fire because it was an unwinnable race. So again, Philosophy Mo is right. It's great that Amy McGrath ran for Senate in Kentucky and gave voters a choice to have their opinions heard. But you can't then control what happens after someone gets in the race and they get a ton of attention. And then all of a sudden, all this donor money is coming in, $90 million that could have been spent on winnable congressional races, winnable Senate races, that in fact came down to like 1.5 points. And then the Democrat lost.
Mo, is political operative Mo in dispute with Happy Philosophy Mo?
I don't disagree with what you just said. That's a function in part of running better campaigns as well. But talking about the balance of power in the United States Senate or the United States House, which are very, very evenly divided, is different than talking about a state like Idaho or a state like Virginia 25 years ago that was dominated by one party in the legislature, in part because the other party was not even competing, in these states. And you know what? Political operative Mo would say, put up some level of fight that you were never going to begin to turn this. And maybe this is colored so much by my own experience working in Virginia politics for a dozen years. But people laughed at us at the beginning of that period because Virginia was so ruby red, there was literally no chance Democrats were going to be able to claw their way back. And they did, in part because of changing demographics, but also in part because the party started to invest in some races, in some seats that became more competitive in part because of that. Doesn't mean they're going to win. And you're right, I would not dump as much money into that Kentucky Senate race or into the Beto O'Rourke campaign against Ted Cruz, right? Those were clearly people just throwing money away. But having said that, if you don't compete in these races, voters never, ever, ever are going to look your way. And you've got to start somewhere, as you said.
Yep.
Okay. Rants and raves time. Sarah, I will go to you first.
I would like to rave about a movie I just saw called The Caine Mutiny Court Martial. I have watched both the 1988 version and the 2024 version. And these movies almost entirely use the same scripts. And so you can see a different cast of actors 35 years apart, sort of what's emphasized in our cultural moment with the same script 35 years apart. And it's really cool. It's also an amazing plot and movie. And I would argue that, in fact, it is what Aaron Sorkin probably based A Few Good Men on, but trying to make the opposite point. Watch The Caine Mutiny Court Martial. It was written by a Jewish playwright in the run-up to World War II. It's so actually just plot amazing, cast amazing, and it's more like 12 Angry Men where it's just in one room the whole time. Very cool.
All right, on my list. Mo?
I'm also going to rave about something I've been watching. I'm a big fan of the Netflix series Black Mirror. I try to have this conversation with my teenage daughter all the time about the negative influences and impacts of technology and how we need to be more thoughtful and careful with it. And usually I just get a big eye roll. So I've started having her watch select episodes with me. And the way it just clicks for her suddenly, in a way, in no way that anything dad says or anything she sees on the news or anything she hears from a teacher does, has got her now openly talking about and thinking about and exploring some of the implications of everything from AI to social media-like culture, to misinformation and disinformation. And I think that's a good thing.
I love that. All right, well, I'm going to rave about news headlines that you can't even make them up. So a Delta Airlines plane was taking off recently from JFK and lost one of its emergency slides just after takeoff. This slide ended up washing ashore near Jake Bissell-Linsk's house on the beach. Jake is a lawyer, and his firm has been busy suing Boeing for safety concerns. And yes, if you're wondering, the Delta plane that accidentally lost its slide in front of Jake's house was a Boeing 767. Jake told the New York Post, "Our case is all about safety issues at Boeing, and this slide is literally right in front of my house." And he added, "We have not decided if the slide is relevant to our case." So there's that. That's all the time we have for today. Sarah Isger, Moa Lathy, thank you as always. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded by Sue Margulies and mixed by Phil Richards. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. We are distributed by PRX. I'm David Green. That's a wrap. Thanks for joining us, and come back next week. We'll have more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.